Welcome back to Lala Beans. This is your host, Lala. Just got done recording episode 7 with my friend Charlie. It was a doozy. He is really, really smart. He knows so much about so much. And we talked about metaphysics. We talked about Freemasonry. He's actually a Freemason, so getting an inside look at that. And also we talked about 9/11 and the Hutchinson's effect, which is
Tesla technology,
basically explaining how the towers came down. And it was just really heavy talking about all this stuff. I mean, none of it is new, but just hearing about the corruption of the world is really not easy. So I think it was important to talk about, especially for people who are newly awakened.
But also, another aspect that I took from our conversation is that I really need to focus more on myself and helping others and doing the inner work and the shadow work. So overall, it was a great episode. I hope you learned something, and reach out if you want any of more of the resources that we talked about. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Lala Beams. This is your host, Lala. I'm sitting here with my friend, Charlie. We're going to talk about a few different topics. I think that with our current political climate, everyone's so focused on what's happening today, this week, next week. But especially for people who have recently woken up, I think it's very important to explore our history and how it relates to what's happening today. I always tell people they need to zoom out a bit in order to see the bigger picture and how it all relates to each other. And like I said, I'm sitting here with my friend, Charlie. We're going to talk about a few different topics, but mainly 9/11 and Freemasonry, and he is a walking encyclopedia, so I'm very happy to have him join me on the show today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Lala. It's definitely a pleasure. I was excited all day for this.
And how are you? Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, where you're from, etc.
So I am in North Carolina currently. I am from Boston, the hub, and I found my path in Boston. I lived there my whole life. I was born and raised there. My family's been there for years. And I was raised in Cambridge. When we say raised, it's the term used by Freemasons for the day of becoming a master in Freemasonry. So you say raised because prior to being a master, you are asleep to a certain extent. So all the language we use in these truther movements, which we have adopted, were the foundation in terms of the language used in that space. Came here to North Carolina because Boston is very blue, and I knew the pandemic was going to happen, and I knew they were going to shut Boston down. And I had opportunities elsewhere, so I just kind of set my sights, and North Carolina was much cheaper, and the people are a little different here down south. I'm up in the hubbub, so here I am. Yeah.
I think I told you I spent 3 years in Boston, so I wonder if we had crossed paths while I lived there.
Possible. You know, you do look familiar. I could probably feel you walking by one day, and now that signature, you know, it's familiar.
So for our listeners, don't stop listening. He said he's a Freemason, but don't stop listening. We've had he's in some of my group chats, and we've had people just straight up leave when he starts talking about it. I think that it's a good opportunity for anyone to learn about it. I knew nothing about it besides just the negative connotations. But
what are those? What are those?
That they are evil and control the world and diabolical to bring everyone down.
When you say they, naturally, you're describing individuals.
Right.
So what I usually find, and this is a good opportunity for people that might be saying, oh, I don't want to listen to this guy, he's a shill or some other, you know, nonsense. Most people that I confront with concepts that are Freemasonic have no idea what Freemasonry is about, but they do know that there are people that are at the top of it who are greedy and who have ties to DC. And they do know, like I know, that the higher tiers and echelons of any system that has its roots in DC has been polluted to the core. With that said, Freemasonry is actually simply an allegorical system. It's like an esoteric system. When you look at it without considering any of the individuals that are holding this society of men up, and you just look at the core truths, it's really the basis of where we get Christianity and the like. It's based on supreme sense of giving to community and crafting a self that has integrity and rectitude and can make a temple out of the earth for all humans. That's basically the edicts of Freemasonry. So people would say, oh, that's just the Freemasonry that's given to lower levels. And really, it's not given to lower levels. That is Freemasonry. But what's happening is at higher levels, people are utilizing and abusing the levers of power. And Freemasonry has a great deal of that power, like any society does.
Right.
If that makes sense.
How many levels are there?
So there's a famous saying in Freemasonry: there's only ever one degree of mastership, and then that's it. When you become a master mason, there is no higher degree. If you are an initiate and then an apprentice, the only moment you become a master is when you become a master, the third degree, and then that's it. There's no other degree that's higher. However, paradoxically, there are various other sects. One stems out of York, England, and it's called the York Rite, and it has 12 steps, and it has various connections to the allegory and the symbolism of Britain. And then you have the Scottish Rite, which has 32 steps, which is essentially synonymous with the Tarot, and it's synonymous with the Kabbalah, which is the Jewish mystical system that most of our society is based on. These are things that, for instance, a truther looks at Freemasonry and says it's evil. A Christian would look at crystals or tarot and say they're evil. But in reality, God creates crystals, I'm pretty sure. And crystals are a big portion of describing the high priest of the Israelites and his chest plate. If you look to the York Rite in Freemasonry, the character that is the allegory the York Rite uses is the king of the Israelites, whereas to a greater or lesser extent, the Scottish Rite uses the Egyptian system. So 32 degrees in the Scottish Rite is just in numbers, because that's the only amount of numbers there are, and 22 of the major letters, which all language stems from, like Hebrew and Phoenician languages have 22, and those are called the major arcana in the tarot. So when you take 10 and this 22, you have this physical and visual system now that kind of looks like my shirt, but there would be like a point here, and then it comes up, and then it spreads, and it goes up, and it comes in and up and out. That's called the tree of life.
Right.
It has 10 sephiro.
And your shirt has the system, flower of life on it, by the way.
Who, so, yours? And
yours, I'm explaining because they can't see your shirt. But
okay. I'm sorry.
And the flower of life for, no, it's okay. And the flower of life for people who don't necessarily know what that is, you can create every like solid, liquid, gas, ether, and pretty much every symbol, every ancient symbol in the flower of life, which you can just give that a Google and see what it looks like.
Oh yeah. And then look up Metatron's, which is basically a set of 13 circles, 12 surrounding a singular one. And that represents a grid in which you can trace out the five Platonic solids.
Yeah, that's exactly solids. What I was talking about. The five Platonic solids and the Merkaba.
Which are basically, for anyone that doesn't know, a Platonic solid is a three-dimensional object which can be cut down one line and create two symmetrical sides. And funny enough, in reality, there are only five. It's so strange, but, and we're talking about moving upward in terms of increasing the amount of size and vertices, but having it be symmetrical down the middle, you can cut this three-dimensional object. There's only five, and they all fit into the Metatron's symbol, both, and this is kind of crazy, but they fit both in the smaller portion inside the intersections and in the larger portion outside, which is basically as above, so below. Five solids traced out on the exterior, which create a sort of empty space in the middle, and then five solids drawn out in the middle, which create kind of that connotation on the exterior. Very interesting.
So is this, are these symbols prevalent in Freemasonry?
That is a biblical symbol, Metatron. Metatron is an archangel.
And they also found symbols like this in Egyptian culture.
And, absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
So just to further understand what a Freemason is what you might call an initiated occultist. There are many different versions of that. There's Rosicrucians. And basically what that is it's a group of individuals that are looking at scripture without dogma. For instance, you and I obviously are having this conversation. You know, you're not a Freemason. I don't think you're evil. Yet when you describe your perspectives on Christianity, for instance, you could look at it as a literal story and you could have your opinions, but you also tend to go deeper and say, well, what's like the meaning behind this? Well, in Freemasonry, because these things are known behind the veil of society, they're known within the lodges of initiated occultists. When you go to a lodge, people describe these symbols in the same way anyone who is scholarly would, and is able to synthesize all these various seemingly different paths and religions through the arcana of the tarot, astrology and its meaning. Those practical systems bind together all the seemingly disparate esoteric and spiritual systems that seem so separate, but they're not.
And you can't be a Freemason if you are an atheist, for example, because you must believe in God or the great architect is what they call it, right?
Yeah, well, they, in the actual phrase, they call it deity. And deity, so deity is just Latin for God. Dios is God, Deus. So with that said, if someone is an atheist, so theist, right? Theism is religion, theology. So it's a consideration of God. So an atheist is when there is no God, right? No, A is like a negating term. So atheist, they're not a theist. So that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a theist. So it's interesting. Now, when you go deeper into esoterica, the word that becomes very important to understand is the word agnostic and the word gnostic. So the original Christian mystics were called Gnostics, just like real rabbis aren't Jews, they're Kabbalists. And real Muslims who practice Islam in an esoteric and mystical sense are called Sufis. And we use these terms all the time. We don't say Sufis are evil because they keep secrets from the rest of Islam. It's just the opposite. The rest of Islam is the masses, and there's different versions of it. And all of them are running a different program, but Sufis have found that internalized perennial practice that you can call anything. You can call it Kabbalah, Sufism, whatever it is, because it's energy moving through a human form. So how do we define that as a system? Well, we got to use terms, and they often have cultural garments. But when you're sitting in meditation, all of that drops away. And now you're in a practice where, without the terminology, you're feeling the very same substance every human on earth feels run through their channels. And there are various systems with cultural differences to describe these channels and these practices. The occultist, an occult just means hidden. Like a cult is when a leader runs a group and hides the truth of where the group's headed. Give me all your money. We're going to find peace. We're going to go to heaven. And then, you know, he takes sexual advantage of everyone and steals their money and does drugs and whatever the cases of power and of greed and sin. Yet then there's the occult where you look at something on a building and someone says, oh, a flower, that's beautiful. Then someone else says, well, wait, look, there are 12 flowers. on that tree, and the center flower is bearing fruit. And when that's seen by me, I say the person that made this building is unaware occultist, creating either something beautiful, utilizing the power of symbol and geometry to interconnect that higher vibration within the world, or, because there's only one force, the force, or some symbol, some vessel that's holding that power and integrating it into a network that's used to subvert the ascendance of man. Like if you look at the Buddhist symbol of the sun, this thing that looks like a swastika that isn't, it's supposed to be taking all power from the center point and giving it out like the radiant sun. And then the Nazis came along and they took the symbol and they just all power condensing inward towards one point. So one's feminine, one's masculine. One is opening up in communication and bounty. The other is gathering everything up for that great culling. And they're two energies that must be in balance.
So where does this misconception, I mean, based on what you're telling me and what I've looked up, it just sounds like they are interested in, you know, secrets of the universe type shit, which I'm interested in too. Exactly. I mean, so where is this misconception born? I mean, I read a little bit about, I think it was Bush or some other president being involved in like the Skull and Bones.
Let's give a history of the Skull and Bones. So the book that everyone should read if they really want to understand how our world became so compartmentalized, where power seems to be structured in such a way where a very small hierarchy at the top can really control so many various apparatus, bureaucracies, foundations, and institutions. The book is called The Anglo-American Establishment. The schools like at Yale that have secret societies like Skull and Bones, they date back to a group of individuals from England. And these are offshoots from things like the Illuminati that everybody knows about with Adam Weishaupt or whatever his name is. These characters have always been trying to bind together a small few of elitist financiers and control the masses through a problem reaction solution mentality, where they create issues, offer the solutions, and feed their interests with the inevitable result that comes from it. With that said, Cecil Rhodes, who got his support from the Rothschilds, in the end, they absorbed a great deal of Southern Africa. It used to be called Rhodesia, and then it subverted back to its African roots, and they split the country up into Zambia and Zimbabwe. But De Beers was created by this man, Cecil Rhodes. The Rhodes Scholarship is named after him. One of his really good friends, this guy, Lord Milner, was a very powerful individual. He had friends like Warburg, who created the Federal Reserve Act and wrote it. Financiers from Europe, bankers that controlled shit since Napoleon's era. With that said, they created a systematic enterprise whereby they could infiltrate all the high prestigious colleges throughout the world, Oxford, Yale, Harvard, and they can plug from families. So Yale Skull and Bones only takes 15 members every year, and they're always these blood-tied members. And that shit's been going on since 1860. Yale Skull and Bones, which is a crazy name, it was originally called the Russell Trading Commission. And it had to do with international business ties attached to the college. But as you know, Skull and Bones is a tomb. Now, here's what's interesting. You go into a Christian church, Catholic, let's say, and there is a dead man hanging on the wall with nails in his arms and his legs. And he's been slit through his belly and he's bloodied and he's been beaten and starved. And he looks terribly. And we're supposed to remember what he went through. And I understand the allegory. It's very important. Nothing to do in the same regard as Skull and Bones or as Masonry. It's different. That's why it's called Christianity. But with that said, when you're a Mason, the third degree, the allegory is you, which you are the vital principle, like the sun's rays always shine and give of themselves until they're gone. And Christ, the sun, gives of himself until he's gone. allowing others to then live because of that sacrifice, right? So the sun and the sun. So there's a lot of correlation allegorically. And Freemasons know this. Now, in the third degree of Freemasonry, I should just delve into what the story of Freemasonry is. We have enough time. Should we just talk about it?
Yeah, go ahead.
But basically, it's like the Bible. Everybody who is a Christian should know the story of King Solomon's Temple. Every Jew should know about the story of King Solomon's Temple. King Solomon had the perfect plans to build a tabernacle, like an incredible temple, and it had all this mathematical and sacred geometric significance. And everyone knows this story, you know, 9 arches and down in the bottom of the cubits. And this whole story is embedded in Christians' minds. Yet Christians will say Freemasons are evil. That is the Freemasonic tale. Every single ritual is you acting out a character in that book. It's extremely Christian, yet it's extremely Jewish, because guess what? They're the same thing.
Right.
So with that said, Jews, what we call exoteric Jews, and Jews, Kabbalists, esoteric Jews, Christians, exoteric Christians, Baptist, Protestant, Catholic, they all think they're Christians, but the Christian brother next to them, for some reason, is a different Christian. It's delusion.
It's very weird. I don't know if I told you, I went to Israel like a year and a half ago and walked through Jerusalem, and that's what I kept thinking is I saw, you know, the Jews, and then there's like, I think it was, I could be wrong, but Catholic or I guess a different Christian, and then the Muslims also, and they're all just packed into Jerusalem, which is just a little city that you can walk through, and they fight and all think they're right. And it's bizarre to me. Wow. It's really bizarre that they can't see it that way.
Yep. They've not been initiated. That is what initiated means. It means you're past the veil. So the word reveal, like Christians use this term revelation. And what a Christian believes is that at a moment of, we'll reveal something that's been missing, and it's coming in the future. But the problem is time is paradoxical. For those who are initiated and who are truly woke, the true sense of the term, enlightened, that is illuminating those darker corners and attachments to ourself, which is false, that moment happens now, the now, which is always here, present. Even when you die, which clearly you're not dead, death still is going to happen right now.
Right.
And we only have to stretch our view of time. So the occultist wears a garment, but knows it's a garment. Most people are attached to their garment, and if they remove it, they don't exist. So if they die, then there's no self there, because they are attached to this physical being, and death happens, there's no awareness. So it's an unconscious death, you know, and most people live that way. But Freemasonry, like so many societies, considers that death, like Tibetan Buddhism considers dying to the separate self by sitting and suffering in a meditation for many hours. So let's go back to the story. Hiram Abiff, he was contracted by King Solomon. King Solomon represents what we call the active or the masculine. So active meaning King Solomon came along and said, I'm going to write the perfect architectural plan, mathematical, certain side of the brain, and it's going to be flawless. But he didn't have the material, mater, the word mater just means mother. He didn't have the form. If he's the masculine singular concept that will fuel this architecture, he needed to find the feminine concept, which is all the material, which would be the form that measurement and that design will organize. So he found King of Tyre. the king of Tyre was this big fat king that had all these riches and didn't know what to do with it all. And he said, hey, that sounds great. I want to put my name on this, King Solomon. King Solomon said, great, king of Tyre. I'm going to take all your shit, but you're going to be a part of this great achievement where man is going to create God's temple right here on the Holy Land. But they didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to use the material to enact his plan. King of Tyre didn't know how to read the plan. So they found Hiram Abiff, who represents the tertiary principle. In this allegory, Solomon is the masculine. Material coming from King Tyre represents the feminine. Hiram Abiff is the triune, trinity, the offspring of the two, who can both read the plan and build it with his hands on the material. So let's continue. This is the origination story for the men with the aprons, right? That's why Freemasons have aprons on. Because the allegory is taking place at the building of a giant pyramid, a giant temple. So King Solomon says, Hiram Abiff, you're in charge. You're the head architect of this job. I need you to create 3 levels of workers. I need you to find master workers that will pay this much. And the payment scheme represents, the currency represents the juice that that individual's knowledge has in the scheme of building a temple, which is an allegory for creating the world. So you wake up and you're in the wilderness. And there's fire right there on the ground and you can just light it with the stuff growing around you. What is the difference between that and the next stage in human life? The temple, the tabernacle, the round room that has the chambers. And this is more than just an actual building that was built. This is an allegory for the temple of the mind. It's the wilderness for the mind, coming into intellect and the fire of understanding, right? Like the fall of man. We're in the wilderness. We're comfortable naked out there in the woods. Then we're naked. We need to cover ourselves, protect with a house and with clothes. That's the fall of man, but it's also the beginning of civilization and of knowledge. So there's a duality to it. You don't know you're awake until you've struggled through a whole life pain. And then once you finally realize what it all means, it's the end now. But there's no way around that. You've got to live it like that. So Hiram Abiff gathers up masters, apprentices, and initiates. And of course, the initiates come first, then they become apprentice and masters. And at a certain point, here's where the allegory begins. And this is where the 3 degrees and the play, it's basically a theater. Imagine like your high school theater. You have people you kind of know, kind of don't. You get to know them. They're all great people. And you're doing this play and you're basically, you're in the 3rd degree. So you're Hiram Abiff and you're the master. And at one point you're just meant to walk in and you begin the scene by walking in front of 3 workers who are jealous of masters because they get more pay. And there are 12 of these workers in this story. Notice the allegory. 12 of these workers, Hiram Abiff. Think of the Last Supper in your mind. Christ, since this story is older, Christ would be Hiram Abiff. And then look in your mind at the Last Supper. You have 4 groups of 3 men or whatever groups are called, groups, little pairings. And the 3 that include Brutus or whoever kills Judas, those 3 represent the 3 winter months in this allegory. And in the story of Hiram Abiff, they say, fucking Hiram, look how fresh his kicks are, dog. He must be getting paid freshly. Let's tell him we just want to get the master's key pass from him, which is a handshake. We're just going to go up to him when he walks away from the temple, away from the other people, and we're going to say, listen, buddy, give us the master's grasp and the key pass to receive a master's pay. And Hiram says, I'm a man of integrity. He says, you can kill me, but I'm not giving you anything. So, boom, one of them gets excited, and they kill him. That individual that kills him, and there are 3 of these men that all take this crime and finish it off. Jabulah, Jabulon, and Jabulam. they represent the three winter months, but one of them actually kills the sun, right? So this is still the allegory. Really, it's Christian allegory. Killing the sun. Can you guess which month the one that hits Christ, the chosen one, or we say Hiram, the anointed chosen one in the land, who was the only one that could do this, the third principle? What month representing in those three men do you think killed him? Which month? Yes.
December?
Yes. Wow. That's the correlation. So basically, Masons are practicing this ritual long before Constantine turned it into a religion, because it's paganism, because it's just a play representative of the universe around. When you make a play like Hamlet, and you do it on stage and you don't know astrology, it's a play about people that Hamlet, that Shakespeare wrote, Lord Francis Bacon and his guild, actually. But when you're an initiated occultist, you read Hamlet and you say, wow, this is an allegory for an astrological sequence and cycle. Same with all of it. Gilgamesh. As a matter of fact, Robert Bavall, who's a famous Egyptologist that I had on my radio show years ago, is this individual that discovered and proved the principle that you can actually use alignments from outer space on buildings by saying, all right, here's a pyramid, and it doesn't really align with much. Oh, there's these shafts here. Let's move space around, preceding the heavens in the way that they would going backwards in time. And we'll get to a point, because the heavens move. It's called the precession of the equinoxes. So you get to a point when you spin the earth and spin the heavens how they would with a simulator. You get to a point where now it's like, wow, those shafts, let's say there's three of them, they line up perfectly with these three very important stars. So we know for a fact that that building was created at a time where those alignments could be utilized. Then the building almost went out of style. Think about that. And you can actually date both buildings and mythos, stories, by looking at the protagonists of the story, like Hercules, a guy who goes through 12 labors. One of them is defeating a lion. I mean, this is astrology. It's the same. But if you look at how the labors are laid out, you can see when that mystic, that initiated occultist, wrote the story. Because embedded in the story for common people, beyond just this tale, which has its own metaphors, heroism, all this stuff, it also has this deeper level where only the initiated occultist can read into. There's a great book called Hamlet's Mill, written by two emeritus scholars, like really deep academic heady shit, but they go deep into all of these stories that are allegories for astrological time sequencing. Very thick book. It's like 1,400 pages. It's intense.
So go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So Hiram Abiff is killed and they bury him in a shallow grave. And the three winter months say, oh, we killed him. What did we do? And they say, you did it. And they all gang up on that one kind of. And then they run and they hide. And then the other nine come from their respective cardinal points. And they go towards the west, where the sun sets, right? And that's where Hiram's buried, in a shallow grave with a sprig of acacia planted over him so that it would grow and eventually hide his body. But it's too late. They found it. So they basically, so you're in this coffin now. It's a coffin, but you're supposed to be buried. And you basically, so you come into this third ritual and you go boop, and they hit you in the back of the head. And you lay back. It's a trust fall, and it's all NLP. It's all neuro-linguistic programming. The way the language and ritual works, it would be like if you used language and ritual to manipulate someone into realizing that they are not their physical body, that this whole universe is run on a program, and it's cyclical. And that's why Masons don't believe in death. I mean, a true initiated individual that's been enlightened is a Mason, I'm describing. A Mason is just someone who builds and crafts with their will, as opposed to through reaction, fear, influence, right? Herd mentality. If you approach a situation and you're influenced by it and you have a reaction, you're actually not willing But if you come up to the situation and you clear your mind, Neo, and you remove what you think is going to happen when you jump off one building to another. But it's like what happens in the Matrix. I'm crossing stories here, but right. No one ever does it on their first time because you have to feel the fall and you have to land and realize that in this simulation, you don't die. This is a metaphor, of course. Don't jump off buildings, please. Yeah, Freemasons just jump off buildings and we don't die.
This is part of the diabolical plan.
Yes. Well, we land on the children that we get from the hospitals we run. Now, are hospitals valuable to greedy, evil people? Hell yes. Everything that's valuable to someone who's trying to do good is valuable to someone who's not. Right. I don't know if most people know this, but the majority of money that's propagating our society and economy is fueled by drugs, trafficking, and murder, essentially. And that's the way it is. If you removed it, like if the DEA got rid of the cartels, no more American economy, gone, done. They hold a great deal of the funds that represent the American economy in place. And this is just a law in nature. So the people, as you go higher up, it seems like they have no values. Like look at Bohemian Groves. Those people are cremating care. That's like the word care, like take care. They cremate it. And if you look at the history of that, it seems very evil. And it is. They used to burn an actual human child. He burned a black child historically, an effigy now, but they closed down this year. However, the concept of burning care is this idea that, all right, anyone loves their family. Like the most evil people are going to protect their family and feel real pain when their family's hurt. With that said, when you have too much attachment to things being peaceful and loving, in the view of the Hegelian dialectic, so this isn't Masonic, this is just the elite, their view is things must push forward. I mean, look at like the common quote from Edison, like there will be a phone in every house, goddammit, and you can't stop it. There's no way around it. The wires are being built around you. If you don't let it into your house, you're going to die and the next person will. And this is like progress. It's manifesting destiny for the planet. And it's all representative of an apex point that we can see coming at us, like a J curve. And you know, this goes beyond Masonry. It goes more into the tantric and Hindu scriptures, but we've already done this game before. You know, we've already went to the other planets. We've already lost the earth to a great flood. And history will tell you before that flood, we had no development. We were nothing, but we know, us truthers know, prior to that flood, the earth was a great harmonic and vibrating paradise covered with giant edifice that vibrated and brought energy from the higher realms of the atmosphere down to be used for all different reasons, imbuing the earth with life force and in turn each human being. And Freemasonry has these details in their allegory. They worship the star of Sirius because that star is the star our solar system is traversing around. There's something called apoapsis, and that's when two planets orbit one another, or two suns. But they don't orbit in two circles. They orbit ecliptically or elliptically, like a oval shape. And they don't circle one another evenly. They circle the center point of mass. So paradoxically, all of the planets are spinning around the sun, yet the sun is spinning around the planets. Yet the sun is so huge and heavy that the center of mass between the two is somewhere inside the sun. That makes sense?
Right.
Because
yeah.
nothing is stable in the universe. Everything is free and moving. So when you take our sun and you see its trajectory, this giant precessional cycle, 26,000 years, eventually we start to move faster towards Sirius B, and we move into a different plane in our galaxy, in a galactic plane. And this other star is so massive that we eventually build up so much speed, and apoapsis is a slingshot around And since that sun is so massive and dense, we basically are doing the moving, and the sun is just kind of there. And it's this incredibly divine character in our human evolution and history in these fractal cycles, because when we move that fast around that sun, the inertial field of humans becomes so intense. Like, we move so fast through the universe, through our galaxy, and in that part, that we lose the density of our physical form. Right now, our density is on its way up. That's why knowledge is building. The dark ages weren't just mental darkness, like the darkness of knowledge and truth, but we were moving slower through the universe, having come around this farthest point away from our sister star, our binary unit. And that actually gives us more of this density and heaviness. The golden age is us essentially reaching this apoapsis and having so much inertial energy that all of us can just move form. The earth is movable with the mind. So this is the story of basically the story of the Bhagavad Gita and the various yugas or time cycles that humans go through. This is the fifth and final yuga, according to this vast cycle.
Is there any books you can suggest on the topic that you're just describing?
So the original book of creation, what we call Genesis, or Yetzirah in Hebrew, is like the best book for anyone to read, Jewish, Christian, anything. And it's extremely symbolic and occultic. And the numbers are all there. Like, so basically that book, Sefer Yetzirah, has to be interpreted by someone, just like any book. And the interpreter I recommend, and one of the most mystical and occult rabbis of our time, is a guy named Rabbi Arya Kaplan, Aryeh Kaplan. That guy's book collection that he wrote, every one of them takes you deeper into the Bible, deeper into the connection between the Bible and esoteric practices. There's actually a book called Meditation and the Bible, and it goes through the Bible, stories of Christ, and it correlates what's being said in those gospels with Kabbalist terms and practices. Like, we know Christ went into deep meditative states, didn't eat for days.
What was that Hindu book that you said?
The Mahabharata. Yeah, Mahabharata, the great tale, basically, or the great story. And the Mahabharata is like a massive collection of works. But yeah.
So that's all very fascinating. Like I was saying earlier, Charlie's an encyclopedia. how do you, how old are you?
35.
You're 35. And what religion would you say that you are, if any?
So religio means to bind together. It's actually the same symbol as a fasci, to bind together like a bundle of sticks. That is religio. That's what it means. And why would you bundle sticks together? Because back in the day, you had to light a fire. So you carried a little string and you went out to the outskirts of your little campsite and you gathered up sticks, right? Mm-hmm. And you bind them together. And that is a powerful, original symbolic concept. If you take a stick, like a twig, and you hit me with it, nothing would happen. It would break. But if you took 30 twigs and bound them together, like, this is what British call a faggot. That's like the real definition.
Yeah.
A faggot, like a bundle of sticks ready for the fire. And a fag.
That's exactly where my middle school brain went.
Yes, exactly. Of course. Exactly. You weren't thinking about anything else. So you say, let me bum a fag in Britain. It means let me get one cigarette, because a pack of cigarettes is technically a faggot because it's a bundle of sticks.
Okay.
And of course, the derogatory term, why you would call a gay person, a gay man, a faggot or a fag, is because he's outside of a gay club with a bunch of guys. They all have penises. So it's just very literal. they're all is one penis among a bunch of penises, physical male phalluses. I mean, that's just the, so with that said, what were we talking about?
What religion you were? That was the question. That
religion, right. So a bunch of penises tied together. So then you look at the fascial network in the body. Do you know what fasci is?
No.
So fascial tissue is like part of your nervous system, and it surrounds all these different separate muscles, but it's like one singular saran wrap. It's called fasci, and it's the term comes from the same Latin term that we get fascism. A fasci is that symbol in Congress behind the Speaker of the House. Are these two bundles of sticks, and on one side at the top is an axe head, like a hatchet head. Those are fasci. If you bind the people's power together, you, the politician, the government, mente, the controller of the mind, can take the masses, which are individually weak. Each mass is deep. They don't know shit. But if you bind them together with social security numbers and credit, and you borrow on their behalf, generate all this power in Washington, you could sign bills using their power. And then you become the axe head. And regular ass politicians are like the thick part of the axe head. But the elite families, like the Bush family, the Walker family, you know, the Rothschilds, these are the sharpest edge of the axe head. So you have 90%, 10%, 1% of the 10%. Then you have the 1% of the 1%, which is like the very tip, the spear point, because that fasci also has a spear at the top. So you go and you look at this, it's in Congress. How is it there and no one knows? Well, because back in the day when they put that shit there, no one saw Congress. They didn't go in that building. You know, no one cares now, so it doesn't matter. Everything is in plain sight these days. Freemasons have a famous motto. It's every symbol always conceals just as much as it reveals. So a flower opens the outer staging of petals and shows its inner side, which is simply just another layer of closed flowers. When that opens, almost displaying the center core of the flower, more flower petals have been created underneath it. And this is the concept of form, the illusion that form both conceals by showing us something, but not giving us the true story, and reveals by showing us something, and our psyche projects onto it and builds something more out of it.
So what religion are you?
So that binding together, so there is no bound version of me. Charles is the religion, because what other story am I playing out?
Right.
So Charles is the anointed one, because who else is the protagonist of this universe? Every universe exists in and of itself, yet paradoxically, they are one and the same. And the reason we suffer is because we think that because this consciousness is embedded in a separate vessel that I can control, Charles can control. Really, Charles doesn't control consciousness. Consciousness controls Charles. To what degree is Charles consciousness? So a long time ago, I died, you know, in many ways, physically and all the other ways that death can happen. Yet, here I am. So what is this? Who am I, really? Am I bound together like a bundle of sticks? Concept, personality trait, habit, fear, reaction? Sometimes, but that, again, is the vessel. It must be bound together, otherwise it just spills all over. Your body's like a sack of fluids. In and of themselves, they're all just sloshing around, yet it's just one individual. Let's break that word down. Indivisible, duality, individual, a duality that can never be separated. That's what individual means. It's the most insane concept. We use it in the most strange ways. That individual right there, it's its own whole, yet there it is, separate from everything. And that's why we suffer, because we think that is the identity of self. It's not. So I don't have a religion. If you could call me something to create a term for it, it would be a cultist. Because a cult, don't forget, not only means hidden, but it comes from that same term we get ocular. The reason we call it ocular is because the eye doesn't exist. Your eyeball is there, but what does the seeing is an aperture. Every human being on the planet has a totally different form except one portion, the space between their eyeball. Exactly the same substance, nothing. And for it to be nothing means all light can come through it. For you to be you and me to be you and all of us sharing consciousness as one, we must all be the consciousness, which is nothing. So that's the root to all suffering, is saying that's a concept that I just mentioned and tomorrow forgetting about it. But my life, what I do personally, because I'm not like going to lodge. I haven't been to a Freemasonic lodge in 6 years. I have no reason to. The lodge is for eating food and getting fat, to be honest. So for those who think people go to lodge and they're like scheming, no. Greedy people that already are scheming took over Freemasonry. And Freemasonry, you should all be trying to clean it out and save it, because it's literally the keeper of knowledge. And it was there when all these big systems, like we all hate the Vatican, right? So why are we hating on Freemasons? They have literally fought the Vatican tooth and nail their entire existence. But why do people really hate the Freemasons? When you ask them, it's stuff that has nothing to do with that story about Hiram Abiff and its connections to Gnosticism and Christianity and deeper elements. It's always about some guy, some writing, some person that said, I was a Mason and my buddy told me that they stuck the thumb in their ass. My cop friend told me, yeah, they kill babies behind the hospitals.
It's always someone higher up that has done this diabolical scheme is all I've ever heard. And I remember the first group chat we were in, I was hearing about, you know, Trump being a free cream back when Signal was a thing before it got hacked.
Right.
I went in there and my friend had just told me all this stuff about Trump being a Freemason. And so I went in there and that was like my first question. And then you're like, I'm a Freemason and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, why does everyone hate you?
Well, I mean, people love me. The thing.
No, not you individually. Right.
Well, I hate some Masons too. I mean, sure. The Masons are people, don't forget. I mean, are we talking about Christianity or are we talking about Catholics? You know what I mean? Like,
well, this is exactly what I always compare it to is, I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I don't really know any other Freemasons. I don't think I.
Oh, you know a lot for sure.
Okay. Well, I've never talked to anyone about it. And
yeah, they're probably nervous that you're going to talk shit about them. It's like,
right.
You know,
why
would they try to, you know?
It's the same way with Catholics. I mean, unless you are just completely asleep still, the Catholic Church is fucked. I mean, besides the pedophilia. Yeah, I mean, it's just corrupt. So does that mean that every single practicing Catholic is evil because the Pope is? No.
No, but they're all asleep. They're all asleep.
Yeah. Well, I think that about religious people in general. I'm sure there's a very small percentage of them that maybe aren't, but I, for the most part, that's what I find is religion is very triggering for people. That's where their line is. They don't want to be questioned by it. And just today, I was having a conversation about, you know, the origin of the Bible and how it's been rewritten hundreds of times. Thousands of times.
15,000 different innovations.
And so I was simply saying that the fact that it's been rewritten so many times with imperfect man, I still believe that the collective consciousness has found its way to keep the truth in there. And it was just met with a little bit of a backlash and just, you know, the same old story about being saved and I need my rapture card and all of this. And I'm beyond that point.
I don't even understand the argument that person had from what you just said. No, from what you just said.
Oh, right.
Like, I get it, but I still, like, if they said that to me, I'd say, I don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean?
I said the collective consciousness and the truth, and they said that Holy Spirit is the collective consciousness. And I was like, well, you just proved my point right there. There's a million words in the Bible that have been changed a million times over. And you're literally fighting semantics with me when I'm talking about, you know, the just reality that we're living in and how the Bible could potentially not be exactly how it was written on day one, which is not something you can argue if you ask me, but
So from the occult standpoint, which I speak from, because being part of a lodge or being initiated, Rosicrucianism is a different system, but the people in it are occultist, you know. Zen monks are occultist. They know they're not monks practicing Zen. It's an illusion. That's Zen. It's all an illusion. Emptiness is the only thing that's real, because when you're in emptiness, you're conscious without a projection to be conscious of. For most people, fear prevents them from squeezing into that space where they allow all to settle and they remain. That's a challenging space. You can't get there. There's no key in the world that takes you there. You can't pay to get there. You have to control. And as Masons say, you have to subdue the passions. Passion means sufferings. You have to subdue them. You have to sit with them. That's what the word asana in yoga means. It means to sit with. So when you're doing a pose, you're sitting with the energy. Your body hurts. It's hard. Your mind reels and you're trying to get out and your breath goes. So the yogi puts himself in that position and holds it. That's called warrior, because you're sitting with the pain and you resolving it in your vessel. Guess what? It resolves it a little bit in the entirety of the soul of the world. That is what a bodhisattva is, the spiritual warrior. So with that said, you had said something, and I was going to clarify it. Sorry, I'm very tangential tonight. You said something, and I said, well, the occult version. What was the last thing you just said? I forget.
Collective conscious and the Holy Spirit?
So if you think about it, religio means bound together. Someone follows a religion. They're now bound into it, and they come to you and they say, oh, you're a Christian. Yeah, I am. Oh, cool. Yeah, I believe this. And you're like, well, I believe that. And then they're all of a sudden, you're not in their religion. They're bound bundle of sticks. You're clearly outside of the boundary of it. So the occultist essentially realizes that anyone who is bound to any system has not yet been initiated and is still suffering through on their path. But you don't say you're an idiot. You don't see this deeper reality of death beyond the persona you're wearing this mask. Instead, you use right action. And since you, a wizard, can clearly see the projections and tendencies manifesting, you utilize their own projections to turn back in on themselves so that they can recognize it and be free of it, much like a psychoanalyst would do. And that's the process of what a guru would do, or what any initiation process is it's basically illuminating the dark corners of who you are. And that's not evil. That is illumination. It's the same word as enlightenment. It's the same word we use in Buddhism. Like, are they trying to take over the world, the illuminated ones in Buddhism? No, it's just a misnomer calling the people that are ruling the world the illuminated ones is just them saying, we know what's going on next, because it's a different way of being illuminated. I'm illuminated by knowing how the age works on the masses, how the processional of the equinoxes affects the earth in a grand time signature and time frequency. So the age that we're in and the religion it represents, like the word Christos, in Latin means anointed one. The word Krishna in Sanskrit means anointed one. in Sanskrit, the anointed one was the ram. And then, whoop, at the end of the age, no more ram. Now the anointed one is Jesus, who's a fish, Pisces. Couldn't be any simpler.
That's exactly what I was talking about today. That's exactly what I was saying.
Oh, that's what you said. Oh my God. Now we're back. Okay. And
I don't think I mentioned it to you, but yeah, that's kind of where I was going with the conversation. Right. I was basically saying that the Bible has a lot of astrology in it, and they corrected me and said astronomy, and I said no.
That's not true at all. I meant
astrology, and then I said the same thing. I was like, when Jesus talks about fish, that's Pisces. When he talks about lion, that's Leo. And the dogmatic part of religion is what tries to separate things of that nature away from the Bible. Mm-hmm. And then they came back saying that astrology is said to be evil in the Bible. Like, they weren't even reading what I was saying. They already were thinking they knew what I was saying without even trying to understand or read. And I feel a little sorry for them sometimes, because they are genuinely trying to help, and they mm-hmm. think that they're helping. It's the same way when you're trying to red pill someone and you just can't, like, you know, religion is one of those. Right. Right.
Like getting an addict off drugs. They haven't suffered enough. You know, they got to go through another life thinking that they're a mask.
Right.
So the reason why so many people associate something like Freemasonry, because some people are misguided, like they'll see something and think it's Freemasonic, but it might be the International Order of the Odd Fellows. Most people have never heard of that. That's not Freemasonry, but it's a initiatory rites that people have been a part of. You might have seen it in your town. It's an eyeball with like little beams coming out of it, and it has three links and says IOOF. There are lodges all over the country, but no one looks at them and says they're evil, because it's like a bunch of old guys. Now, what are they doing at the top? Who knows? But the reason people associate these groups, initiatory groups, with evil is because, like I said at the beginning of this, they all use symbols that have power. Some people use those symbols in this evil way, and they use them all over the world. And the people that are using them, because the symbol has power, they just immediately associate it. Like, if I were to start a company with an eye, because I like the eye, like, let's say my brand is like an optometrist, and you just see a sweatshirt, like, he's Freemason Illuminati. It's like, dude, he's an optometrist. He likes eyeballs.
Right.
So if you look at Washington, D.C.'s layout, for instance, this is a phenomena. It was created by this Freemason named L'Enfant. And this guy created this amazing structure out of DC, which has this crazy layout. And if you take it and you align it with a cross section of the inside of the Egyptian pyramid, the math is all the same. So this is a phenomenon in occultism where people wrongly assert, when they see that L'Enfant somehow knew what was in the pyramids. But he didn't. They had not been opened yet. No one knew what was in there. There was no recording of it at that point. There were stories in Egypt. People knew, like, from stories, but they hadn't been surveyed. There's no maps. And the reason it correlates is because L'Enfant used ancient sacred geometry that the pyramids were built with. And in the end, so much across the world correlates together because of that, you know. The initiatory individuals of each culture are using the same math and principles of math.
Have you heard of the Coral Castle here in Florida?
Yeah. So the Coral Castle has been explained. It's all there.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Big time. Yeah. There's actually a pretty obvious room where the flywheel exists. Basically, he used a series of mechanical leveraging devices, and he spun objects on like singular stones. Basically, you like take a giant stone and you put it on like a round, hard stone that's like the size of a marble, and you can like roll this huge stone with very little friction. And he would do that, strap it, and use a flywheel that he would crank, and he would be able to move it, and he could do it all on his own. So really, you know, no magic, no vibrational resonance like I once thought before I saw a famous mechanical engineer go there and say, this is what all these devices are. They're all there. There's a little house in Coral Castle that has the flywheel. It has all the leveraging gears and all the little tools like teeth that he used to walk the stones around the flywheel. Very interesting. You can find that on YouTube.
Yeah, it is. I haven't looked
into that. But the guy's still a genius.
For a while. Yeah, I haven't looked into that for a while. So, but yeah. Speaking of vibrational resonance, and you know, we got pretty deep in there. I love contemplating physics and pretty much anything with high charge topics.
And high charge topic, was that a pun?
No, it actually was.
Are we talking about vibrational resonance? The high charge topic.
I wish I could take credit for that witty joke.
Witty the Pooh, I'm going to call you.
But I'm the type of person who knows like a little about a lot of different topics. I feel like you know just a lot about a lot.
Let me be honest. Can I say one thing quickly? Sure. The reason it seems that is because my system binds everything together. There's no separation. So the view that the perspective I hold, the view would be called an integral system. So it seems like I know a lot about a lot, but for me, all those things that seem like they're all separate are all one. And it's, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's, I mean, I definitely think it's all interconnected for sure.
Go read a book by Aldous Huxley, who wrote, you know, Brave New World. Aldous Huxley wrote a book called The Perennial Philosophy, and it's about the core occult philosophy embedded within
each and every.
He wrote
The Doors of Perception, right?
Yes. Okay. Have you read that book?
A long time ago.
Aldous is a great, great writer.
Wait, is that the guy who created acid or no?
Who created what?
LSD.
No, Albert Hoffman.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Yeah, Albertus Hoffus. Yeah, thank God. Thank goodness for that man in his bicycle day.
That's actually what I'm doing an episode tomorrow talking all about hallucinogenics and all of the times I've done LSD.
Oh, I've done LSD probably 200 times now.
Yeah, I've done it a lot. After 7, you're clinically insane, mm-hmm. So maybe that just explains why we're sitting here having this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much died on opiates, so insanity is the least of my karmic issues. That's why all day long, my livelihood, to some certain extent, has to be 100% authentically working and trudging through other people's karmic debt, other people's karmic residue, like their traumas. Because if I don't do that, I can't like ascend at all in life. I know that for a fact. Like I could ascend in life in the way that society sees ascension.
Yes.
Like I could take whatever I fucking wanted from anyone with the power that I have. But the ascension I'm looking for is the inward one. Like I said, you can't get into that temple with a key. You have to shave yourself down so you can fit through the eye of a needle. You have to be emptied to get into paradise. And to do that in life before just being violently stripped of everything at death and being in fear and not getting into paradise, you have to do it. This is very Christian. This is every religion, truly. This is every spiritual path. You have to do it by working with the ones that are unfortunate and hurting around you, if you can help them. And if you make that your livelihood, then you sit on the mat and meditate. Some reason, it's like a lubricant. Knowing that you help people and really doing it and really feeling what it feels like to inconvenience yourself to bring someone higher, you just like gain momentum in your own practice. It's a law. It's a law.
That's interesting.
Because I have a lot of karmic debt. You know, if I sit on the mat, the terrorizing story that is Charles's suffering, like all of us have, arises, and that's why people don't sit in meditation. It's scary. So what do you bring to that? What force? You can't bring fire and power and knowledge, because that will enforce and strengthen your own tactics and manipulative fears You can't fight fire with fire. You can't think your way through a process where you have to unthink. So you do the meditation after giving of yourself to a job. And if the job is greedy, you'll hold karmic residue from the job. If the job ascends others around you, then you sit in the meditation and deep down in your soul, no way to fake it, you feel good. It feels good. It's good. I mean, this is the definition. It's good. You helped others with the traumas that heavy them, which means you helped the whole, the wheel, the big human condition, just by helping one, you know.
That's something to think about, for sure.
Think about it, doggy.
Especially because when you think about doing, you know, sitting for meditation, or it's almost a selfish thing because it's all about you. But the way you describe that with the lubricant and helping other people, I also think that's something that can't necessarily be fake. That comes into, is it altruistic if you're doing it for your meditation practices only? You have to genuinely want to help people, I think, for something like that to work.
Well, the root of it is you are not your persona, your mask. All these masks are all fake simulations of a singular projected trauma. The projected trauma is us forming. It's a trauma because it's like Frankenstein. It's like a science project. It hurts. My body has to poop some brown substance out. If I don't eat, I die. If I get hit by a piece of steel, it rips me open and it hurts. Sensors in my body give pain to my... I mean, this is like a savage... What's the point? You know, why? Why do we have the antenna of this vessel? You know? So it's deeply fearful to just be. And to resolve that trauma is to identify through a period of detachment, practicing that detaching. Identify not with the being, you know,
right,
but with what it isn't. So they asked Buddha, who am I? And Buddha said, neither this nor that. And that's an answer of negation, and it's dualistic. So you're not this side of things, and you're not that side of things. You're not on this side of the aisle. You are not on that. You're not cold. You're not hot. You are a vessel that holds this line, this linear perception, which is an illusion.
Well, after talking about all this, like, is 9/11 still interesting?
Yeah, it was funny because I found myself talking about getting hit by a shard of metal and getting torn open, and I thought, well, this is perfect.
It
like
really,
in 9/11.
It really is interesting, honestly. And like I was saying way earlier, well, when we first met in the group chat, I really liked that group because it was obviously what was happening during the time, which was right before the inauguration. But there was so much other topics being discussed, like spirituality and the history of how we got here. And one of those things that I actually learned from you that I never even heard about was the Hutchinson effect and how it relates to 9/11, which after doing some research, I now understand it as what could be Nikola Tesla's technology.
Absolutely. Yeah. The
death, also known as the death ray. Right.
Yeah.
So another highly charged topic, 9/11. It was one of the biggest attacks on American soil during our lifetime. And when you're dealing with these highly charged topics, I think this is by design because you're seen as insensitive or an inconsiderate piece of shit, essentially, just because of the lives that were lost and the families that were affected on this horrific day. So if you're questioning the truth about this day, a lot of people don't even want to open that can of worms.
Right.
And while I honor the lives lost to the deepest extent, I still know that we were fed a lie to what actually happened on that day. So some people still buy the story that we were told on that day. Some people think that the planes hit the towers and that's actually how the towers fell, which makes no logical sense because jet fuel doesn't melt steel. And
the and way also the towers don't fall.
Yeah, like nothing, if you just look at the video, fall. It's literally impossible for that to happen. Others, I think a more common one that people think, especially in the truth movement, is just that it was a controlled demolition, it was a bomb or however. But when you watch videos of buildings that had controlled demolitions, it takes time and you can literally see the floors, you know, going out as the bombs go down. But after watching Dr. Judy Woods talk about it, and what makes the most sense to me is the directed energy weapons rather than a mechanical collapse or an explosion. They didn't burn up. They didn't slam to the ground. They turned to dust in midair.
Mm-hmm.
So
the dust is a nano or a monoatomic powder, which means singular atom. So what you saw is in science, it's called, I'm sure you heard this in the video, but it's called a pyroclastic cloud, which only occurs with thermite explosions of that high heat, volcanoes, or as Judy Woods posits in her videos. And by the way, Judy Woods, as her credentials are, her history is basically she's called over to like attacks where they blew up a building, and she's asked to do the forensics and determine like with this pile of rubble what happened, you know. That's what she does. She's an expert in that. She's done it for 30 some years, and she comes into this conference and all of her lectures saying, I don't want to talk about who profited and all this other conspiracy stuff, although I found it's important. I am here as a scientist and I don't want to dilute the message. That's what I love about her presentations, similar to like Christopher Dunn with his like analysis of Egypt and the pyramids with the Giza pyramid. Just the science. So she looks at it and says, okay, well, the buildings, if you look at the pile of rubble, the amount of rubble that remains can be measured just by looking at the 110-story buildings against the backdrop of buildings and knowing how high everything is and looking at an image of that and saying, okay, well, this is then 40 feet and that's 100 feet there. And at this point on the building, it's that. And then she shows very simply free-falling buildings, a giant dust cloud, and then the pile of rubble. And this is what she deduces, which any scientist can deduce themselves. The pile of rubble is so small that the amount of matter that made up this building had to have been pulverized, right, into like non-existence. And the only reason we know that it was pulverized in what she calls dustified or demolecularized into the finest of powders, powders. The reason we know that is because A, it's not there, the physical material. It didn't land. The footprint of the buildings fell into themselves when there's supposed to be 110 stories of matter getting stronger exponentially as you go lower in the floors. Instead, it free fell all the way to the footprint. So where is that matter? Well, when you look at the video, it's a giant pyroclastic cloud that covers all of Manhattan and beyond. So then scientifically, you can say for that much pyroclastic substance to exist, that is like ultimately monoatomic powder, dust, for that much to exist, it has to equal the missing floors. So it's just too simple. So the floors
really
that are missing are in the air and everyone breathed them in. And she also has analysis of why all the cars in the area were totally just turned into like molten, because this powerful energy weapon was frequency calibrated to devastate a building of heavy steel and concrete, yet things like aluminum were just like turned into nothing. That's why not a single file cabinet out of 50-something thousand was recovered in the rubble at 9/11. And think about it. And you can literally look at images right after the towers fell and analyze hundreds of little points of data on the image with like everything thing a building would have in it, all exposed because it's just fell to the ground. And there's just no file cabinets because they're all aluminum and they disappeared because they were directly hit. The cars surrounding were hit by the collateral damage of this energy weapon. Paper was floating in the air, falling, because paper was made of wood. And it wasn't affected by the frequency of the energy weapon. Maybe we should describe what a DEW is, a direct energy weapon.
Yeah, maybe you should.
So basically, what Hutchinson shows, and what you can see in his various analyses on YouTube, is he shows that, and this is Tesla's original understanding, everything is vibration. Everything is sound. The word persona or mask, person, really means person by sound. Like perfume means by smell, by fumes. Smells by smells. So with that said, Tesla knew everything was vibration, and he knew that everything had a frequency, which is its like vibrational resonance. So the reason something is called steel isn't because it's a substance that is steel. It's because the universe's one singular illusory form simply has a density vibrating at that particular density, which makes it look like steel because of the bonds that have locked it in, these laws that have locked it in. So what Tesla realized is everything is held together. And it's all made out of this similar substance. Like everything has carbon in it. Everything is this similar substance once you apply this weapon to it, if it can be affected by this weapon. And what the weapon is it's sound. And it's vibrating in a frequency, like a beam, a wave moving at a very high frequency, which means there's a lot of waves in a very small span. Instead of a large wavelength, it's a short wavelength. In like the millions of hertz. So it's like so many of these little waves happen in a certain distance. So if, to really put it in your mind as a visual, what the wave is doing up and down, right? Picture it in your mind. The wave goes up and it goes down. And if it's a big wavelength, like a very low pitch sound, it's a big wavelength. But then when we make it smaller and smaller, it's eventually, right, going to be such a high pitch frequency vibration that it's the same length, the waves, the same width, the same length as an atom. So now picture a piece of steel. It's a physical ingot of steel, like a steel block. It's made of steel, atoms. And they have a certain distance, and there's laws between their electrons that bond them together that make it steel. That's why it's called steel. The electrons, you know, think table of contents or table of elements. So you take this vibrational resonant frequency, which is this particular length of waves, and when you know what's called the keynote resonant frequency, which is the same resonant wavelength as the distance between the atoms of the ingot of steel, then this sound beam, which is very high powered, takes a lot of power, but you can aim it at anything, and it just hits the thing and the thing just goes away. Like there's no friction. It doesn't affect. Just disappears and dustifies. You saw it that day. So the wavelength is such a size where it goes in between the law, the energetic bonds between each atom. Now the atom, which was bound together and so strong like steel, because sound easily goes through steel, and if it's at the right wavelength, it'll break these waves, these laws that bind the electrons together. The steel will just turn into dust. And that's what happened that day. That's a direct energy weapon in that case. There's other ways to do it. You can use that same technology to just devastate anything. Whereas what they did is they used thermite preparations that blew the major steel grid beams of the building as they removed the building from existence while it fell. So they shot this weapon at it and then blew up the substructure. And as the building collapsed, they made it disappear in thin air. Like, whoa, that's crazy.
How do you think they were able to achieve a frequency that high to accomplish that?
Well, what would trouble that achievement? It just has to do with the oscillation. I mean, like, so.
Do you think it's coming from like a device nearby, or you know, in outer space, or what?
Well, Judy Woods thinks either a plane or a satellite of some sort, or both. I'm likely to believe it's a satellite system of some sort, or right. a weapon system that was somewhere exterior. Some people say they saw something floating. There's different angles. There's an orb. There's a video that has this orb that floats in, like above. And some people say it's a plane at 30,000 feet that just kind of looks like it's moving across. And, you know, who knows at that point. But the truth of the matter is, like you said, it is the same technology as Tesla discovered, because there is only one unified field of resonant frequency that the universe, seemingly disparate in all these various forms, is actually one fabric with various vibrational densities. And consciousness is the sort of empty spaciousness within which all these densities play out.
So another thing that she kind of went into, if anyone wants to watch it, I think she has a couple of things that you shared with me. I watched the Dr. Judy Woods presentation from 2012, Breakthrough Energy Movement. It was a conference in Holland, and it was 2.5 hours long. I think, wasn't there another documentary that she did, what was it called?
Yeah, that's her production that she did. It's called Irrefutable. It basically shows what I just said. It's irrefutable that there was no mass, and it was irrefutable that the mass was in the air around the buildings.
And she talks about the different weird properties that don't fall in line with any of the other theories. So there's really low heat, the unburned paper, like you were saying. She studied.
Well, yeah. Let me just say what she would say is the amount of energy that would have released to make 220 stories of steel and concrete pulverize into dust. Mm-hmm. Like, first of all, when you demolish a building, you don't blow the building up. You just hit key points and it falls into itself. It's all still there, though. Yep. So what she says is the amount of energy that it would take to release all these molecules of steel into dust, if you used combustion or explosion or anything we know of that scientists could talk about at an academy, at a school, there would be an amount of heat. It would be like it would be Hiroshima explosion. Like, only an atom bomb can devastate everything into dust, but it does it through combustion and explosion, where this just sends a ripple, a wave of energy through, and it just dismantles everything and turns it into dust like that. So it's a lot less energy, and that's the comparison. A Hiroshima is a massive release of energy, right, from a singular atom. Boom, and those two atoms, boom. But this, almost like coerces every atom involved to give up. Instead of using one atom to explode all the other by engulfing all of them, it tells them all.
And that's another thing, is she studied the seismic impact, which would not fall in line. She also brought up the seismic impact. So if it was an atom bomb, it would have a way bigger seismic impact, whereas it was very low.
And she would know how big the seismic impact would be, because she can measure the density and mass of that structure, and just an average, like approximate it, and say, all right, well, to explode this much matter, you would need this much thermite and have this much, you know, whatever you just said, seismic explosion. Yeah. Yeah. People believe that shit. It baffles me. It's like a tree. If you like knocked the top of a tree off and it kind of hit a lower trunk, it wouldn't crush it all the way down to the ground. It's the most insane thing. Anyone who has any reasonable intelligence that is very smart, but they don't want to believe it because of the dissonance, what they say is what the Nesty or whatever the group that like determined what happened that day, forget it. They said that the explosion had created like a heat. And when the sprinkler system in that section of floors hit this very high heat, it exothermically reacted, which means when you take water and turn it into steam, it takes up a lot more space. So basically, that's like a huge explosion. Like, that's what blew up North America, is when a comet hit an iceberg, had hit the ice shelf, and it was just from ice to steam, from water to steam. And they say that blew up the whole building all the way down to the first floor.
Well, I just think people can't wrap their brain around the type of technology that's being hidden from us. I think that's the biggest hurdle. And just also not knowing. Maybe they would believe it if they knew or they heard her presentation, for example. But they just don't know.
Well, people don't understand how such a nefarious operation can be orchestrated without people speaking up. Or how come all these people were involved? But what they don't get is people do speak up all the time. Like, that's how we know about it. And people get eradicated, you know? Yeah.
So the Hutchinson's effect was just what? Because it was the same thing, but Hutchinson was another scientist.
So this is what Hutchinson does. Using the same technology, you can do these things. You can turn an item depending on its vibrational resonance and your ability to create the keynote frequency of that resonance and harmonize with it. Like the example that you give in a science class, because you talk about this stuff in a regular science class, the example you give is one of this famous bridge where the speed of the wind that passed through this valley and hit this bridge had a vibrational resonance that was the same length as the bridge swinging. So it was like a music. It was like, you know, when you like jump on a trampoline at the perfect time and you launch your friend way up, then you jump at the perfect wrong time and you absorb all of their jump and they get muted and their jump loses its power. So this happens to things like a bridge will have, they literally have scientists now, engineers that say, all right, well, the bridge length is that long. If the bridge swings at this frequency, it'll go faster and faster, like a kid pumping his legs on a swing, and the bridge will break itself up. Bridges used to do that until they measured for that. And that is when you harmonize the wind and its vibrational resonance with the length of the bridge and its swing and density and mass and the center of mass. So if those things harmonize, then you can break the bridge up with just wind, just the wind, because the bridge is breaking itself up. And that's what Judy Woods is trying to say. That's why it's not all heat and energy. It's just the bridge is like, you know, I've had enough to fucking carrying you motherfuckers around. I'm out. Yeah.
Yeah, it is mind-blowing, really.
So and simple, too.
What about the Rife machine technology that you brought up? I didn't really look. What is that?
So basically, Rife was a doctor many, many years ago who invented a technology that basically was already invented. I mean, these are things Tesla discovered, and he didn't discover them. That's what the pyramids all over the earth were. What Tesla did at that tower in Colorado is a revival of what he knew was already done in ancient times. Tesla didn't discover it. He looked around like we have and looked at the ancient pyramids, and then he brought his knowledge of vibration and electricity and math and said, I know what the fuck was going on. That's why he was an enemy, and that's why he had to be silenced and crushed. He knew that at a time, energy was brought down from the ionosphere into these giant temples using water and vibration and sound, and it was used to fuel human beings and used to create electricity that was usable and could be passed across long distances and through the earth and through the ley lines of the planet, and they buried him. And that's basically what's going to be instigated on the planet after the culling, which is this point where everyone's going to be killed off, which obviously anyone who's awake can see that there's a concerted effort by the Economic Forum and the World Health Organization to turn the Earth into something like a Petri dish, an experimental Petri dish, Brave New World stuff. What did you ask me originally?
Just about the Rife machine technology.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So yeah. So if you have a section in the body that possesses cells, and one of them is a healthy lung cell, and the other one is a lung cell grown that thinks it's a liver cell, so it's cancerous. That's what that's a form of cancer, right? Like the cell's confused, it's in the wrong spot. Some confusion has happened in the body. What the Rife machine uses, the same vibrational resonance, and in a second, I remember what we were going to talk about. I'll talk about the other Hutchinson effects. That's what we call them in the academic setting in the school he ran in Canada, wherever, Montreal, Toronto, Vancouver, Canada somewhere, British Columbia. So basically, Rife discovered that you could see, all right, well, this is a liver cell in the lung. So let's find the density and vibrational resonance of a cancerous liver cell and shoot high frequency beams at it. And when you find the right resonance, here's the cell, and you can go online and see it. Here's the cell. It's cancerous. It's going to kill you someday. And you can see it. And the resonant machine hits it, and the cell goes, and it blows up. And then the other cells around it absorb it. That's a real science. It's been around for 100 some years. It kills cancer. You can buy that machine. It's like, you know, some thousands of dollars. I don't know. But,
really?
You know, naturopathic doctors use it. Vibrational resonance is a real science. But people will tell you it's not, because they don't want to believe that it's just that obvious and that simple. Plus, some of them probably make a lot of profit.
Right.
A lot of money to be made. And you can't make money off healing people. You know?
So, Dr. Judy Wood, she didn't want to talk about, you know, why 9/11 happened, mm-hmm. motive. And I'm sure you've heard that some people think it has to do with the first stages of Nisara. What are your thoughts on that?
It was already written in the 80s. It was called A Project for a New American Century. It was written by Wolfowitz, Daniel Wolfowitz, and Zbigniew Brzezinski, whose daughter is a news anchor, of course. It's all Project right. Mockingbird shit. Mila Brzezinski. Her father is like the Kissinger of his time or of his sphere, wherever he's from, fucking Hungary, fucking Nazis. With that said, they wrote this shit. And what the Project for a New American Century was, is it was a plan to go into the last seven countries without centralized banks. It's actually a clip you can find. It was on NPR where a general said, oh, we got this thing, 9/11 happened. Oh, no, sir, we're not going to, you know, we're not going to, Saudi Arabia, we're going to Iraq and then to Afghanistan first. And the general's like, what do you mean? And he's telling this story to the woman from NPR. And he's like, yeah, here's the document we got. And he looks and he's like, oh, holy, you know, we're going through these seven different countries that have nothing to do with 9/11. And this general's saying that, and this is what's unfortunate. The general is, I don't know why things happen. The general fucking knows what I know. The general knows about the Project for a New American Century that the neocons wrote in the 80s. Why is he going on NPR talking about, oh, I got this document, and they said they're going to go through seven countries. Wow, and then we did. Libya, you know, and he names them. And it looks like a general that realized this, had this epiphany as to the nefarious mode. But, dude, I know that he's lying because I know that he knew. I know they all know. I can always tell when these motherfuckers are lying. That shit was written in the 80s. Everybody knew that was written in the 80s. And in the Project for a New American Century, PNAC agreement, it says we're going to dominate this whole sphere, geopolitical power, for 100 years, save some Pearl Harbor-like event, in which case we can do the whole thing within 10 years. And, of course, what's the Pearl Harbor-like event that they landed on? So it's always a multi-prong. There's many problems you have to solve. So when you make a big, big, big scheme, it's many prong. Number one, the 9/11 buildings were all asbestos, and they had to be torn down because the way they were built with the steel outside and all that heaviness, they couldn't be changed out the same way. It was a disaster. It would cost them a lot. The Port Authority had the price so high on those buildings. Even though they were shit and they had to be clean, no one would ever buy them. They would have just sat there and been rotted. So the state, New York, which is a corrupt state, they had an issue with that. So somehow the Port Authority ends up selling these buildings very, very expensive
to Larry Silverstein. He buys them. When he buys them, he takes out an insurance policy, which anyone would on big building, but he pays extra and stipulates what's called a double indemnity clause. He literally buys extra insurance, stipulating that if there's more than one terrorist attack on his buildings, he'll actually be paid out twice. He got that payout. You can go find that shit. Bush family controlled the security of the buildings right up till 9/11. The Carlyle Group, which was Bush Sr., his lobbying firm, go look up the Carlyle Group. It's basically eye to eye with Bain Capital. Bain Capital's Bill Gates Sr. and that whole line, the Nazis. And then Carlyle Group, Bush, Walker family, all these other families, and the ties with the Bin Laden family and the other Saudi elites. And they had a meeting the day before 9/11 at the Carlyle Group with the Bin Laden family and everything. And then after 9/11, the Bin Laden family were able to leave the country where no one else in the whole country was able to fly. They got a private plane and they were able to go back to Saudi Arabia. Just the Bin Laden family is very interesting. They had a war game that the Pentagon controlled, which was basically Vice President Cheney controlled it, the war games. And the war games, which were planned for some weeks, this is just like with the coronavirus shit, the war games stipulated an attack by hijacked planes hitting the Pentagon and hitting 9/11, hitting financial centers in New York. So they had a war game going on. That was what happened. I mean, that's simple. That's what they do with false flags. Then later you have someone like Bush, the president, saying, how could we have known they were going to hijack planes? They were doing a war game. That's how stupid people are. And of course the news isn't going to ask. They know. So right. then you can just keep going with it. There's so many more drastic tie-ins that make it obvious that it was just and then, you know, Halliburton gets this massive contract to go in to Afghanistan. My buddy fought in Afghanistan in the first 3 years of the war. He just brought back the poppy farmers that the Taliban had kicked out because they are religious fundamentalists. And they believe that Afghanistan is their country, and they don't believe that it should be growing heroin for American profit. America said, bad terrorists, give us our heroin fields back. First stage, Afghanistan. Heroin fields, good. Let's go to Iraq and get the gold and oil. And you know, even though it has nothing to do with 9/11, 9/11 was orchestrated by Mossad, Israeli intelligence, CIA, and the House of Assad, Saudi Arabia intelligence. And that's it. They did it easy.
That's just, it's super heavy stuff when you think about, you know, and this isn't the first time that America has done something like this. Or,
well, I mean, yeah, it's not America, really.
Well, I was just going to say, but they were all involved also. They knew
This is definitely the next stage in the elitist agenda.
Yeah.
It's esoteric in nature. The Twin Towers fall and they build a singular tower. That is the epitome of their enterprise shifting from one of duality into a centralized one. It was the moment the entire planet, like they planted a flag in front of everybody and no one did shit about it. The whole world said, holy fuck, look at these individuals just orchestrated something that the whole world's looking at, and they're going to use it to take over, like, most powerful wizards. And there's very little to be done there, you know? They showed it on TV in high school.
Yeah, how old were you when that happened?
I was a sophomore watching it in high school, sitting at my desk. They wheeled in a TV to every single room. And if they didn't have enough TVs, they just brought a couple rooms together and everybody watched the second building get hit all together. And of course, there was an influx of patriotism and nationalism and just what's needed to go to a war that has nothing to do with anything and make a shitload of money. The whole scheme is so simple. Instead of letting soldiers build, like, first of all, we weren't fighting anyone. We were stealing oil and terrorizing people for information and rebuilding. So I had a guy on my radio show named John Perkins. He wrote a book called called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. So here's the layout. You are the World Bank, and you are an apparatus of very powerful families, and you don't want to be doing business as those families, so you create these world foundations and bureaucracies, and they do everything. You go to a country that sucks, and you say, all right, here's the deal. I'm from the World Bank, and you're a great dictator. Look how beautiful your military outfit is. You should have more weapons. I'm going to give you $400 million from the World Bank. And don't worry, you know, you can steal 40 million of it. Here's a couple of offshore accounts where you can keep it safe. They'll let you do it. And the other 260 million, we want you to make sure that we're on the same page. You can spend 60 million of it on military shit for yourself, and you'll look so fresh. You'll have the best materials. You'll look so strong. And you can tell all your people that you just got this shit and you're the strongest new leader. And you get to spend it, though, on these companies and get these goods. They're the best. Trust us. Then you have to get all this municipality work, like all this water refinement and energy sources and, you know, power stations. And let us redo your sewer systems. And we're going to come in and you're going to spend $200 million with Bechtel and Halliburton and all these other massive companies that run the world. And the contracts are going to be way inflated. And we're going to come in and do a shit job because we don't give a fuck about you. And you don't give a fuck about anyone either because you're going to steal the money. And by the time anyone figures it out, you and your girlfriends are going to be out of here. And that happens. And then the next group comes in. And you know what they say? They say, we're going to stand up to you politicians and bankers because we're from the new movement and we're resistance. And they put up the fist and they say, you know, you can't just bribe us. So they give them more money. Maybe that works. Maybe it doesn't. So then they say, all right, no problem. Then over a short period of time, because there's always a way to turn that into benefit and profit. So if that's happening, you have a group that's really, they want to keep the throne and they want to be good people and be do-gooders. That's fine. Fund them secretly. Have them do good. Have them build their army. Have them protect their ideals. That's great. That's one side of a coin. Then the CIA or these world bankers, they'll fund the other side too. They'll create a fucking other side if they have to, but it'll be there anyways. They fund both sides now. They let them fight out. They keep funding them so the juice rises and they see which side handles the funding better and is more bound to the money and to the drive to reach power. It's sycophantic. Even if it's a good ideal, it's sycophantic. It's power hungry. Then what they do is whichever one wants the money more and wants it more, they stop funding the other one. And then the person that wins, obviously, is the one that's been funded by them the whole time. So this is how they create a CIA sort of duality, problem, reaction, solution. Sometimes that doesn't work. Like with Saddam Hussein's instance, he said, I'm no longer going to accept dollars for the oil that I offer on the world market. Only euros. And Donald Rumsfeld, who put Saddam Hussein into power in the 80s, came back into power just to take him out because he had a lot invested in it. That's why he put him into power. You don't put people into power controlling vast oil enterprises unless you are their handlers.
Who put him into power?
Donald Rumsfeld.
Who?
He was the Donald Rumsfeld was the secretary.
I was like, what?
And funny enough, Donald Rumsfeld was also the CEO of Searle Pharmaceuticals, the company that created aspartame. And he famously was attacked by a lawyer that was protecting the rights of consumers because aspartame was dangerous and it was in baby food, Gerber's. And famously, Donald Rumsfeld presented himself to this lawyer in his own turf. And at the end of the meeting, the lawyer worked for Searle Pharmaceuticals. And fought in court and made it so aspartame can still be used in the trace amounts it's allowed. Donald Rumsfeld is a fucking wizard. I mean, he's a fucking evil man. But in all honesty, the plan that they set up was as if they just orchestrated for the world whatever they wanted and no one had any way of stopping them whatsoever. Just so interconnected.
And there's another documentary, too, that you told me about. Was the JFK to 9/11 a rich man's trick?
Everything is a rich man's trick, yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic synopsis of history. Same families. Harriman family, the Warburgs are the old family, the Walker family, the Bush family.
It's like, even though I know maybe not all of what you said, but I know the corruption and the nefarious tactics behind 9/11 specifically and in our government every day in the world, it's just like leaves me right now with my stomach like turning. And that happens sometimes, you know, whenever you get red-pilled or you learn more about something, like when I learned about the child trafficking, I had to take a step back and I couldn't even look at it anymore for a while. So that's kind of like how I'm feeling right now after digging into it.
I mean, yeah, thank God you've never perceived it in reality. I haven't. I mean, I've never, like, some people have like seen it, you know, they like found someone that was running from a, you know, situation. I mean, that shit is everywhere, but other countries, man, I'll tell you, in other countries that shit happens and people are numb and callous to it. People don't realize what they have in this country. They really don't. It's sad. It's very sad.
And that's some almost
countries, that shit is like normal.
Like saying fuck America now.
Yeah, because they're easily programmed, and the program is fuck America, because that's Marxism. People don't get what Marxism is. They also don't know what communism is. First of all, any Freemason knows that the four energies, fire, sun, earth, and water, right, are the four major governmental organizing systems. And you can't have any government or any system or any society without all four. So you have to have a type of capital. Capital just means the thing that comes first. So is it wood? You know, do people need wood to burn in their homes? If they do, that society has wood as its capital. We don't use wood. We use electric or gas. So, of course, a lot of capital, money, currency is tied to the resource of oil. So fucking people say they're against capitalism. They're fucking in a house, dude. They're in a fucking house. That's burning a fuel. It's the capital for their house. I hate everyone. No one's gone to an economy class. Like, it has nothing to do with greed. It's not greedy to need to fuel your house. It's fucking nature. Like, it's not greedy for an amoeba to absorb smaller organisms into its membrane. It's not like, I am so greedy. It's hungry, dude. It's a natural organism. I'll stab everyone with my amoeba. And then, so you need capital for any system, some type of capital. A car has gas. You need a commune, the group that relates to one another. A society has a commune. That's why they're all voting, right? Like, and then you say that's a republic, but that's another word for it. So it's public. Here's the public, and then there's a republic. It's when you sort of take what's public and you make a smaller version of that public. It's a smaller commune of the community at whole, at large, the world community. So you have various tiers of community or communes. Like, your home is a small commune within a fractal communities, moving out in all directions into the galaxy, the largest commune that we can be a part of right now. So with that said, you also have socialism, where that group, that's inevitably a group, as a societal norm, they have societal laws, that there's a societal culture to it. And you share things, like, we all have to make sure the streets are good. So the community has to band together in some way. We got to pay for it with the capital. And then finally, because all of that has responsibility, and not everyone can have the higher positions, there's hierarchy. And hierarchy inevitably has people up here managing people down here. And when you take a group of people down here, there's a lot of them, that's chaotic. So what do? You have to bind them all together through some system. Corporate structure calls it the management hierarchy. It's like it's a structure that if you ran a business and you were an anarchist, like, there's people that are like, I'm an anarchist. My record store, like, we believe in anarchy. It's like, all right, so everyone's the owner here? Like, I don't get this. It doesn't make any sense. It's not possible. Everything's a hierarchy in nature. Who had the idea? Who started anarchy? Someone didn't think of it. So are they following their own anarchy? No, they're literally following someone's system of organization. They're just calling it anarchy. There's no such thing as anarchy, because once you call it anarchy, it's organized now. You've organized it. You've defined it. It's not anarcho anymore. If you call it anarcho, you fucking regurgitator. So well, now you have all four always.
There's nothing that makes sense these days with
except for complete insanity. You gotta just be insane to fit in. Just walk in, you're like, "What? As seen on TV. And if you buy now, you'll receive an extra dildo shaped like a sword." It's like, dude, I'll take it. Look at the way you're presenting it.
No, the craziest people now are just ones who like fresh air. Don't want to wear.
Yeah, I mean, I showed you my videos. I'm here in North Carolina where it's purple. Like, it's supposed to be blue laws, but people here are red. So there's like a battle. And it's starting to open now that some states have put their foot down. Like, businesses are like having live music outside and things are becoming lenient by decree. But then people are taking it further just by their own freedom. And I, from the start, was on the I have a medical condition shit. I was on the phone with Best Buy. I was on the phone with Walmart. I talked to the fucking head dude at Walmart that day, and I got my little piece of paper that I can show someone later, and I did what I needed to do. And some businesses weren't having it, and the cops were called, and I said, "Listen, this is what they said." And they said, "Hey, listen, you know, the only thing we can do is trespass you because they are a private business. And if you do say that it's strictly for discriminatory purposes, they made you leave. We can't enforce that." See, cops can't say, "You can't discriminate. Let them shop here." Once the business owner says, "You're done, get out," and you're trespassed, and the cops come, the cops have to trespass you. But you do have a right to go to civil court and sue the balls out of them. That's what America's all about. But what am I going to do? I'm going to sue the scared old lady that runs the thrift store? Like, "You son of a bitch." You know, like, what am I going to do? She's scared. And she's taking my rights away out of fear. And that's why Germans were scared of Jews, because they believed that they had a special Jew virus. I don't know if you knew that, but people don't know that these days. That's how it started. It wasn't like Jews are bad because they have less genetic whatever. That's what they try to tell you in school. Right. Like the motherland and the great Aryan race. That shit didn't sway people. They had business to attend to. They had families. They didn't believe in that shit. That shit already happened in past generations. But slowly, little by little, they created an idea that some Jews had like a genetic virus, and that they had to wear this triangle on their arm. It's not the Jew star. It's a triangle for sickness. And it preceded the Jew star, because first it was sickness. Then it was, "Oh, the Jews seem to get this sickness really easily." Then it was, "Let's just outline the Jews because they seem to have the sickness." So now it's just Juden on the arm. And that's it. And that's because the Jews held a lot of the control in the country. And that movie, Everything's a Rich Man Trick, like I said, everything that these elites perform in a world stage has many prongs. The Russian czars, who were the cousins, uncles, and aunts of the other royal families in Europe and abroad, they were murdered by the Bolshevik Revolution, and Marxism was coming into the rest of Europe. Germany had already been destroyed by World War I, and they owed a bunch of money. So they were just destitute pieces of shit that had nothing and could easily be bought. A bunch of rich people came together and they bought a man, a thug that they could use as a gangster. They then funded him and gave him the best Autobahn highway, the best airplanes, the best phone system, the best chemicals. And they said, "We're going to give you all this, Hitler, and you're going to be the Führer, and you're going to go out and, you know, you need to do for us after we make you the Führer is you're going to pay us in resources and ore and oil and coal." So Poland alone had 13,500 concentration camps. You think they were just there to house Jews because they hated Jews? These people don't care about what your religion is. They want money. They want to steal stuff. They use that as a front. And in the end, Hitler, he didn't just get addicted to morphine and lose control at the end of the war. He had all the support and funding of the Lord Montague and the Bank of England and the Harriman brothers and the banks in New York, Wall Street. He had all their support. Winston Churchill praised him. Vatican gave him an award, Chancellor of Germany, an award. But then they made him do these things. They said, now's the chance, Hitler, and this is what the plan's about. Hitler goes out and he's attacking, he's battling. They support him. Then they say, we're going to make a bunch of money. We're going to come into the war. England, America, Russia will come into the war too. That'll get rid of the Bolshevik Revolution. All those people that killed their cousins, they'll now be pulled in, and winter will kill all them anyways. So we'll have them devastated. So the elite were poised. They were poised to steal everything from Europe, art, gold, teeth, everything, the gold. They were poised to destroy Russia, destroy it. They were poised to destroy Hitler, this creature that they created. All they had to do was stop. This is like what I said earlier. Stop funding Hitler at a point and fund Britain and America more. Britain and America devastate Hitler. Hitler's hidden in Argentina, so he can't fucking be found. And then they now control Europe with the United Nations. They control Israel and create it. They control Germany now, which owes this debt, this restitution for this war, whatever they call it. And it was like on the order of 180 something billion dollars that ended up going basically to the Bank of England. If you look at the paper trail, it's insane. It's a huge scheme. They go ahead.
I'm just going to say, we've been at it for 2 hours.
Anytime you want. I'm exhausted. I could just go forever.
I'm just going to say to anybody listening to this,
we can do part two also.
Oh yeah, you'll definitely circle back. Don't worry.
Circle back. So funny. So you sounded like her. It just gave me. I like puked a little because you're so beautiful, and you were like, circle back, and I'm tired. I was like, Jen. Oh my God, my buddy goes. Oh, sorry. What'd you say?
I have to say it. It's ironic. I hate her so much, but I gotta say it every once in a while. It's like Tourette's. It's like circle back Tourette's. But I just want to say thank you so much for, sharing your wealth of knowledge. And do you want to tell the people where they can find you?
Oh yeah, Ouroboros Yoga is my Instagram.
So you are a yoga.
Yeah, I got some studios, but really, I'm nothing. I just that's the enterprise that's I'm most readily able to clear people's karmic debt. If you think about it, I can bring them to their edge physically and then bring them into their emotional and mental tendencies, allow them to confront them, digest that, build new responses, and then empty out and release and let go and start anew. And I just do that with them again and again, kind of like rinsing and sponging out human souls every day.
I wish I could go to one of your classes.
We have a day of yoga happening in North Carolina called the Day of Gratitude, which is awesome. It's like a bunch of presenters. It's basically a little one-day yoga festival that if someone was nearby or wanted to take the journey. So if that's something that you're really interested in, we're going to have a day that's just going to be an awesome way to kind of feel free again and feel like you're part of a community of healing and positive vibes.
I love that.
Well, studio is called Gratitude. It's in Raleigh. So you could like find it online and see all that. Gratitude Studios.
Awesome. And otherwise, if you want to ask any further questions, I can direct you to him. You can find me at Lala Beams on Instagram. This was episode 7 with Charlie. Thank you so much.
Thank you.